You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Christina toku ingoa. Nō mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Tuesday Wire for this week, the 12th of April. My name is Christina and I am your host for the Tuesday Wire, and producing for the show today is Trisha. How are you going?
I'm doing pretty well, running on very low sleep, but you know how it is.
I think that's kind of the vibe around the station today, but we are working our butts off to bring you the best content from the news, from art and culture. So if I can coming up on the show today, I have my regular catch up with AUT Professor Alan Blackman for Dear Science. Today we're talking about the anniversary of the first man in space, researchers separating a complete genomic sequence for the very first time, and a physics puzzle that may change how we understand the universe. I'm also reporting on the ongoing economic and humanitarian crisis in Sri Lanka. I'll be speaking to economist Anushka Wijesinger and the constitutional lawyer Bhavani Fonseca. Anika is speaking to Dr. Shane Reti from the National Party about the Māori Health Authority and $21 million in wasted vaccines.
And I spoke to Ganesh Nana from the New Zealand Productivity Commission about calls for new regulations on genetically modified organisms.
He aha or whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, or any of your thoughts at all. What are you reading at the moment? How are you enjoying the weather? And hopefully some good things coming through. So tuku patui mai, you can text us on 5395 or Waiamairane. Give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Also after the show, kaua e ware ware e ahe na koutou te whakaro ki inei kōrero anō. Hei pakieri rukiruki maronga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho. Me haere ki 95 BFM ira katikom. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95 BFM website, 95bfm.com. Let's go.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hopefully we have Alan on the line at the moment. Alan, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Christina. Can
oh
you hear
gosh,
me?
Oh my gosh, awesome. This is so cool. We're doing this remotely and we've got some cool scientific tricks to bring you Dear Science for the day.
Yeah, how are you going? Science in action. How am I going? I'm in isolation, unfortunately. I'm a close household contact.
Oh, no.
My other half has gone and got COVID. So, I'm just sort of sitting around seeing what will happen, I guess.
Well,
yeah.
I hope you and your partner are keeping safe at the moment, because it cannot be fun getting COVID at these times.
No, absolutely not. Yes,
especially
yes.
With all these weird variants floating around as well. So,
But everybody who says it's mild, she's really not happy. So it's it's a bit nasty, this. So
well,
I'm
definitely
hoping I don't get it, but
hopefully.
Anyway.
But we've got some cool stuff on Dear Science today. We are, first of all, talking about the anniversary of the first man in space, which is obviously a very big deal, but let's go into why.
Yeah, absolutely. April the 12th, 1961 is really a day that should be celebrated by humankind all around the world, because it was on that day that 27-year-old Yuri Gagarin became the first human to go into space. And with what we now know about space flight and the amazing things we've done, it might seem fairly modest that he was only up there for 108 minutes and he completed one orbit of the Earth. But when you consider, I guess, the state of the art as it was in 1961, number one, this guy was extraordinarily brave, just beyond my comprehension, really and honestly. He's just, everything that could have gone wrong, and he got up there and did it. And I think that the great thing about this was that this first manned space flight was the culmination of literally centuries of scientific progress. And, you'd go all the way back to, at least Isaac Newton with his, with his three laws of motion that were in the late 17th century. So things like, you know, the technology behind rockets, the fuels that they use for rockets, you had to know all about gravity to get this spacecraft up there. You had to know classical mechanics, again going back to Newton. You had to know the effects of forces on the human body. You had to know how to parachute. You had to know all about vacuums. All of these things, all of these advances in science came together in this one moment on April 12th, 1961. And I think, you know, it's one of the greatest scientific achievements of all time, sending somebody into space and, most importantly, recovering them alive.
In one piece. But, yeah, this is kind of the moment that was the culmination of a very long race to space between Russia and the US, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. And, you know... Probably without that competition, it would have taken a lot longer. But, you know, it was all this sort of chest-beating stuff, the Cold War, all of that, you know, all of that time. And, you know, he was an extraordinary brave guy, and I was never quite sure what happened to him, actually, but very, very sadly, he died in a plane crash only 7 years after that, in 1968. This was some routine training mission. He was a jet fighter pilot in the Russian Air Force, and... yeah, the circumstances of his death are sort of shrouded in mystery, but a really sad ending to, you know, a quite remarkable man and an amazing achievement and something that we should just maybe reflect on today. And you know, all of the science that went into getting it up there, and these days to me it's very, very sad that all of the science seems to go into making weapons and stuff like that now. That seems to be humanity's first thing when they come up with new technology or whatever it seems to be. How can we use it in weapons? And that's just got to change.
Yeah, and there's so much left on this planet and, of course, beyond it that we can explore. I think a very small proportion of the ocean is actually... yet to be explored as well.
Yep,
so it'll be really cool to see someone brave the depths, but it's definitely not going to be me.
nor me, yes.
Our second topic for today is a bit of good news. Researchers have done some really cool work and created a complete sequence of a human genome for the very first time.
Indeed they have, and this might surprise listeners to this show because they probably thought that this was done back in the year 2003 when the Human Genome Project, remember that? They basically announced that, yep, they had done it. They had got the sequence of the human genome. But they were being a little bit disingenuous when they said that because they had got basically 92% of the genome, okay? And so there's obviously a remaining 8%, which at the time was thought to be a little bit difficult to do. Well, quite a lot difficult to do, actually, otherwise they would have done it at the time. And they sort of thought that this remaining 8% was what is termed junk DNA. They didn't know what sort of purpose it had or anything like that. There were lots and lots of repetitions. It didn't seem to code for proteins like DNA does. And so they sort of said, well, you know, we'll just leave this for the time being. And I guess the time being is now because 6 papers in the journal Science, 6 have just been published, about this remarkable achievement. So what they have now done is a gapless sequence of the human genome. And by a sequence, I mean essentially reading the alphabet of DNA, which is A, T, G, and C, and looking at these 3 billion or so base pairs, each of which is labeled A or T or G or C. And so they've got it now. They've absolutely done it. And this is thanks to improvements in sequencing over the last couple of decades. And what that has allowed researchers to do is to sequence the bits of DNA in longer bits, essentially. So back in the Human Genome Project, they did it sort of like 100 or a couple of hundred base pairs at a time. And now they can do sort of 20,000 base pairs at a time. They can even do up to about 1 million base pairs at a time. And that made the job substantially easier. So we now have it. We now have the human genome. And now the question becomes, what are we going to do with it? Because
it's kind of something you'd have on hand, but if you can apply it, it's a bit useless. You just have 3 million letters just sitting around.
3 billion. Yep. Jeez. 3 billion. So our job, or humanity's job now, is to decode this. Because if you can decode all the information in DNA, then basically you can do anything. You know, that's your blueprint for every individual human on the planet. You know, everyone can now technically get a copy of their own genome, and we can figure out eventually what all the bits do, you know, what every last little bit of DNA does. Now, that's going to be an enormous undertaking, but you know, we've now got the basics. We've now got those letters in order, and so, you know, I'm sure there's lots and lots and lots of people around the world who are head down getting into this question as to what it all means now. And you know, it's quite a remarkable accomplishment. Just amazing, you know. Crazy. Right up there with spaceflight, really.
Amazing. And we don't often think about incredible achievements happening at the genomic level, but it is something to absolutely recognise.
Yeah, for sure. Yep, absolutely.
The final topic for today is a bit odd, I would say. I say this as someone with no scientific background, of course, but there is a bit of a mystery being introduced that has kind of confounded scientists, and now they're a bit confused as to how we understand the universe. Some key bit of information has risen, which has ruined a lot of people's lives, apparently.
Well, yeah, well, that sort of remains to be seen. But yeah, it does kind of look like it's going to make many physicists question their science, I guess. And so what you're alluding to is a fundamental particle of the universe. Now, I'm a chemist, and we chemists think in very straightforward terms about what makes up the universe. To us, that's protons and neutrons and electrons. Mm-hmm. And that's it. There's only three that we need to worry about. But if you're a physicist, you go deeper and deeper and deeper, because of those three, only the electron is what we call a fundamental particle. It can't be broken up into anything simpler, whereas protons and neutrons can. Okay, so they are actually made from smaller particles, and these smaller particles are either fermions or bosons. And they've got weird names like quarks and leptons and neutrinos and photons and gluons, etc., etc., etc. And you've got all of these fundamental particles, and they make up a thing called the Standard Model, which is what physicists, or basically how physicists understand the universe, really. So all of these fundamental particles. Now, we know that the model at the moment is incomplete, because it doesn't work for gravity, because there are these particles that should basically transmit the gravitational force, and they're called gravitons, but nobody has seen them yet. But of particular interest here is a thing called the W boson. And that's a fundamental particle that's really important in radioactive decay. And it helps mediate a thing called the weak nuclear force. Now, the big thing here... scientists have spent 10 years gathering data about the W boson, and they've also spent about 10 years analyzing those data, and they've come out with a mass on the basis of those data, a mass for the W boson that is too heavy.
Oh dear.
And you might think, oh dear indeed. Now, the model predicts a certain mass for the W boson. These experimental data now say it's heavier than the model predicts. And It looks to be statistically significant, this difference. And so this has got a lot of people quite, well, not upset, but let's say very, very, very interested, because if these measurements are correct, then they're going to have to rethink the standard model, because they don't gel, I guess, with the ideas of the standard model. So the first thing that somebody needs to do is to, dare I say it, repeat these experiments. And as I said, they took 10 years to gather the data and 10 years to analyze it.
And there are other measures. Has been just undone. You have to do it again.
Well, somebody's going to have to repeat it and make sure that this is absolutely correct, because there are other measurements out there that aren't as precise, but they agree with the value of the standard model. So big ructions in the physics community at the moment. This has the potential to be enormous, because if they've got that one thing wrong, then they're going to have to rethink the entire standard model, and that's going to have massive implications for physics. And who knows, even just the basic science and stuff like that, the way that we think about the universe. As I said, things like gravity, things like dark matter that we don't yet understand. But this is the beauty of science. Science is ever changing. And if a model is shown to be wrong, then we just need a new model. We need a new model and a better model. And that is what might become of all this. So stay tuned.
Yeah, it seems to me that the theme of today's Dear Science episode is that, things are always changing, and if you think science is boring, then you would be dead wrong.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love it.
There's always something to discover. That brings us to the end of Dear Science for today. Thank you very much for joining us from your nice, safe home. Hopefully you guys are keeping it safe.
Thank you very much. And everyone else out there, keep safe as well.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Thank you again to Alan for joining us from his home. He aha o whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of today's pieces. What were you doing on April 12th, 1961, maybe? So tuku patui mai, you can text us on 5395. We'll be back after this.
Wow. Music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
April features Princess Chelsea, Sudan Archives, Toru Moa, Noah Slee, and more.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for a monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
Arcade Radio, Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
When I'm in a New York state of mind.
Arcade Radio.
Show me that you're mine, girl. All right.
For all that and a heavy dose of fine tracks, tune in to Arcade Radio. Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. with Mike, Jono, Eddie, Nat, and special guests every week. Arcade Radio. Only on 95 BFM.
You're on The Wire with Christina and Trishel. Sri Lanka is currently facing the worst economic situation since it gained independence from Britain in 1940. Now Sri Lankans are protesting against the government due to widespread shortages of food, water and medicine. A local Sri Lankan describes the crisis like this. They went into infrastructure development borrowing money. However, when the pandemic hit, the foreign exchange earners of remittance, tea and tourism dried up. The government didn't heed the warning signs and continued borrowing and infrastructure development instead of trying to save the economy. Then we had no foreign exchange to buy fertilizer, gas, fuel and medicine. They were not honest about the situation because they thought the Sri Lankan public didn't need to know. They began to say going organic would be the way to go and other rubbish. They printed money to pay for stuff and inflation ran away. They refused to go to IMF because then they would have to abide by demands they weren't willing to abide by. On top of that, the government is corrupt, despotic and racist. This is what Auckland-based Sri Lankan Shanika Samadalaka had to say about the crisis.
Well, I think the main problems are economic. That's what the main problem is. But we got to keep in mind that this is an unprecedented crisis, both economically and politically. We've seen a bit of political instability in recent years when there was a coup back in 2018, but there wasn't a humanitarian crisis like we're seeing today.
Yeah.
We're talking about pre-COVID times and people weren't having to line up for essentials back then. So I think this is mainly driven by the shortages of petrol, food, milk powder,
medicine,
electricity. Yeah. Absolutely. So yeah. This is largely economic issues that we're dealing with today.
But how exactly did this happen? I asked Sri Lankan economist Anushka Wijesinger.
So, Christina, Sri Lanka has been having economic troubles since the start of the pandemic, and we had worsening economic conditions on the back of an already weak economy after the Easter Sunday terrorist bombings in April of 2019. And since then, the economy has been weak, but the pandemic tipped things over the edge, and the government just couldn't get a grip on the declining state of economic affairs. There was almost a sense of over-optimism that with the pandemic waning away, that everything will go back to normal. And also there were a few policy decisions like irresponsible tax cuts, a ban on agrochemicals that affected agricultural production. So a whole bunch of decisions that led to where we are right now.
What impacts has this economic crisis had so far?
So just to paint a picture of the economic conditions in Sri Lanka at the moment, we have many hours of power cuts. People around the country are faced with anything between 4 hours and 10, 12 hours of power cuts. We have people lining up at fuel stations and at cooking gas queues to try and get basic cooking gas to fill their car up, and transportation has been affected. And now increasingly, there's also a shortage of certain types of medicines and some food supplies. And these recent shortages are because there's a lack of foreign currency in the market because of all the economic challenges we've had and a fair amount of economic mismanagement. We have a shortage of dollars, essentially, to import all these items that Sri Lanka doesn't produce, the fuel, the cooking gas, some medicines and so on. So that's where we are today, and that's why people are on the street protesting. We've now entered probably the 10th or 11th day of continuous protests, which have been quite unprecedented because we haven't ever seen, at least in my lifetime, I haven't seen this level of consistent protests, young people coming out, staging a non-stop protest in front of the president's office. So yeah, it's quite extraordinary times here.
Who has been hit hardest by this crisis?
So I think the urban poor, so urban poor and the middle class and poor in urban areas and semi-urban areas probably hit the hardest, because in rural areas, you could find some way of sourcing, you know, food. You know, Sri Lanka is a very fertile country. Yes, there have been fertilizer shortages, but self-sufficiency in some basic food items is possible if you're a rural family. If you're, of course, a very wealthy family, it's obvious that some of these cuts won't affect you. But that middle group, particularly those in urban areas where they rely a lot on cooking gas, they have to commute back and forth from work, you can't just grow something to feed yourself, and the price rises have been highest in these urban areas. So inflation right now is at nearly 18% inflation. So it is these groups that have been worst affected, and probably the urban poor in areas like Colombo, who were already badly impacted by the pandemic. Daily wage workers who already saw a cutting of their incomes didn't get much relief from the government because the government didn't have the fiscal space to do it. So I would say that is the community hardest affected. Primarily informal workers, daily wage workers, those in urban, you know, urban areas, the urban poor will be the worst affected. But this crisis has been so pervasive that everyone is affected in some way or another.
And finally, what are the possible options to lift the country out of this crisis?
So in terms of the economic crisis specifically, right now, we have to put a standstill on our debt repayments in an organized manner. So we have some big debt repayments coming up. That is international sovereign bond repayments coming up in July and a few other smaller repayments in the next few weeks and months. So the only option to try and stop the bleeding, if you will, is to get a standstill on this debt and work with the International Monetary Fund to work out some kind of a bailout package. So this would help over the next 6 months to 1 year in postponing some of the debt, restructuring some of the debt, and getting some much needed assistance coming in. Beyond that, it remains to be seen. Sri Lanka has some structural challenges in the economy that would take longer. In terms of the political crisis, I think that one is harder. I am not able to speak too much about the political options, but it seems a bit of a stalemate right now because the president doesn't seem to be willing to go. But on the economy, it's more clear what needs to be done, and we can see the government taking some steps in that direction, appointing financial and legal advisors for the restructuring, you know, appointing a new central bank governor and a new treasury secretary. So hopefully these will be fast-tracked so that the immediate pain that people are facing could be reduced.
The Sri Lankan government has also played a significant role in bringing about this crisis due to nepotism and corruption. Shanika Samadalaka says this.
So in, you know, in 2019, when President Gotabaya Rajapaksa came into power, he had executive powers, two-thirds majority in parliament, and yep. His promise to the people was that he was going to have this team of professionals on board to implement various programs across the sectors, which would boost the economy and make up for years of economic mismanagement in the country. But he failed to keep his promises. So there's a whole lot of factors, and I believe that's what contributed to bring about these protests.
I also spoke to constitutional lawyer Bhavani Fonseca about the Sri Lankan government and widespread corruption. She describes corruption as entrenched within the country's history. Since 2019, the president increased his powers and appointed several of his family members to high-ranking government positions, including his brother as prime minister. She says corruption has always existed, but it has recently become clearer how widespread it is. She says there are two avenues for Gotabaya Rajapaksa to exit office. The first option is for him to resign. However, he has, quote, dug his heels in, unquote, and refused. The other avenue is for the president to be impeached. The ability to impeach a president is enshrined in the Sri Lankan constitution. However, it is a long and complex process. She says Sri Lankans do not have time to wait for this. There are reports of people dying in the streets from standing in line without food or water and being in the hot sun for hours. She says people are dying from exhaustion. This is an economic, humanitarian, political crisis that needs quick action. You're on The Wire. I'm your host, Christina, and here in studio with me is Trishul, my wonderful producer.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
In the first of our new weekly segments with the National Party's Dr. Shane Reti, Anika speaks to him about the party's desire to abolish the Māori Health Authority should they come to power next year, as well as the $21 million in vaccines that have just expired and therefore been wasted.
So the National Party has come forward saying that the Māori Health Authority will be disestablished should the party come to power in the next election. How would you suggest an alternate system to address inequities faced by Māori in our current healthcare system?
So I absolutely agree that there are inequities for Māori, and the often used example is life expectancy. That's 7 years difference, and I've published on these in the past. So absolutely agree, no question. It's just how we go about addressing them that I disagree, and disagree that a Māori Health Authority will achieve that goal. I do so for several reasons. First of all, as is written in the Paiora legislation, a Māori Health Authority is described all in terms of structure. It's all in terms of form. I'm interested in health outcomes. Tell me the health outcomes that a Māori Health Authority will address. And I know some of the answers to that because the regulatory impact statement from the government describing the Māori Health Authority says there will be no benefits for the first 5 years. That's too long to be building up structures. The second reason why I have concerns that it will fail, and indeed that Māori are being set up to fail, is that the Māori Health Authority has a terrible conflict of interest. It is a commissioning agent. It's there to purchase services. But it's also the monitor of the system, so it will monitor its own purchasing. That's a terrible conflict of interest. I think at the end of the day, what we need to understand is that if we really want to shift the dial on Māori health, it will not be a Māori Health Authority that does it. What it will be is the co-determinants of health, which is income, employment, housing, education. That's actually what will shift the dial on Māori health. So in our hands, what we would do is we would absorb a Māori Health Authority into a very strong Māori Health Directorate within the Ministry of Health and commit to Māori health outcomes. In our first year, we won't wait for 5 years. I will make commitments to Māori health with targets and outcomes that I'll hold myself accountable to in that very first year of the privilege of being in government.
Now, I just want to go back to what you were saying about structural change not being what the focus needs to be on. Do you not think that structural change looks at the systemic issues that are the reason why Māori face severe health inequities in our current system. I mean, our current healthcare system was built by Pākehā for Pākehā, and it seems that the Māori Health Authority looks to dismantle some of those inequities on a systemic level. A Māori health directorate does seem like it would try to work with the current model instead of injecting change into the current model. And many would say that this top-down approach would not be enough compared to the on-the-ground approach of the Māori Health Authority. Would you agree?
So several parts to that. First of all, let's remember, in 1840, Māori life expectancy was 30. Today, it's 73.4. So that the discussion that it hasn't worked for Māori for nearly 200 years, we just need to reflect on that for a moment. But I think coming back to the form over function, the description of all of the government documents around the Māori Health Authority are focused on localities, regional offices, district offices, relationships with this board and that board. None of that interests me. What interests me is, tell me about immunisation, tell me about waiting lists, tell me about cancer. Start with that first, which in fact is a bottom-up approach. Start with the outcome you want, and then what governance do you need to get that outcome, rather than, well, let's figure out what my job title is going to be on my CV, and then we'll get round to the health outcomes.
Yeah, sorry, just going back real quick, did you say that Māori life expectancy in 1840 was 37 point something?
No, 30 years, actually.
30 years.
Actually, yeah, non-Māori weren't far away from that either, but in 1840, life expectancy for Māori was 30, and today...
No, but as you just said, non-Māori weren't far away from that either. That was very reflective of the time and the technologies that they had available to them. I don't think it's particularly relevant to be bringing in those statistics now that we have access to so much more technology, and we do have the means to really help people live a lot longer.
Well, I think it is, because the argument's made we need to do something different because the system hasn't worked for Māori for the last nearly 200 years. And I bring that up as a, well, how do you explain that then? How do you explain that huge increase in life expectancy? And maybe what that also talks to is, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are some good things that have happened, a large number of good things actually, with Māori health providers. But I keep coming back to focus on the language of health outcomes. That's actually what matters.
Now, I just want to look at the recent open letter that was penned by a number of NGOs, including the Cancer Society, urging the National and ACT parties to change their stance on scrapping the Māori Health Authority. These organisations are very on the ground, privy to the daily struggles faced by Māori in the health, in the current healthcare system, and they think that the Māori Health Authority is the way to go. Why does the party disagree with those organisations?
Several things to that. First of all, you'll need to wait until Pai-Ora Bill comes out of committee to see how the legislation has been changed. And I think Māori will be disappointed and they're being set up to fail. So I make that point. Can't say any more because it's still in committee, but just hold your breath and wait until that comes out of committee and back to the House. Second thing is, the Cancer Society is a really good example. One of the big Māori health inequities is with cancer, particularly lung cancer. But then we need to explain why, when Andrew Little removed the cancer health target in December last year and put in place 12 health indicators instead, cancer is not one of those 12 health indicators. One of the biggest inequities for Māori, New Zealand's biggest killer, and it's not even monitored as one of the key 12 indicators. Furthermore, when the Cancer Society took him to task over that, he said on television, one, they were quote-unquote off the planet. So I think there's a real reflection there as to intent of what this government and what the bill is actually going to do. Just by exactly those signals that have been sent to cancer. I'm using cancer as an example. But again, wait for that bill to come out of committee, and I think Māori are going to be disappointed.
Now, I do want to spend some time talking about the Māori Health Directorate, as, you know, if that's going to be the alternative should the National Party come to power in the next election. How is a Māori Health Directorate going to work? I mean, because this is replacing the whole DHB system. So how's it going to work on the ground?
So that's a good question, because as you say, there won't be DHBs. If we're privileged to come into government 15 months in, there'll have been 15 months of implementation. No one knows what it's going to look like, where we're going to land. So I can set very general directions, but if we're successful, where we land in 2023 is still a bit of unknown for everyone. But the general general direction of having a Māori inequity focus inside the Ministry of Health. There have been Māori directorates before. I've worked with them for a number of years, actually, and my observation has been that they needed more resourcing, more funding, they needed clearer targets, achievable targets and timelines. And these are the sort of things in a ramped up, significantly ramped up Māori Health Directorate that we would be able to do from the inside.
I mean, could you put some numbers around severely ramping it up?
Until we look under the hood and see how much damage has been
done.
Well,
even just a rough idea of like resources and personnel and stuff would be useful.
None of us can make any comments. And furthermore, what I'd say to you then is ask the government, what are their numbers for a Māori Health Authority? They won't even describe how many FTEs they're going to place into a Māori Health Authority. So if the government can't, a couple of months out from full implementation, then no, until we've looked under the hood, we'll be able to make those sort of figures.
The other thing that I wanted to look at today was a press release that you sent out a couple of days ago about the $21 million worth of vaccines that have recently expired.
Yeah, it's actually $25 million because there was another $4 million of measles vaccines that expired at the end of March, and my question was answered about March 15th, but more than $20 million of expired vaccines. And if we look at that, $8 million of a botched measles program that was started in July, 300,000 people were the target audience, and they delivered 10,000 by the time they closed the program down or paused it in March. And my understanding, even today, there may be only 20,000. 20,000 of 300, wow, that's a botched program. 1.6 million in meningitis vaccines. The tragic situation of the Rushtons who came to Parliament with their petition for their young daughter who died of meningitis, Courtney. And yet nearly 17,000 meningitis vaccines allowed to expire, that's the quadrivalent vaccine, allowed to expire and gone up in smoke. And they are bitterly, bitterly disappointed, as is the Meningitis Foundation, that those vaccines weren't offered to them before their expiry date, and they would make sure they went into the arms of young people through primary care and other providers. And really the third strike was the $12 million in shingles vaccine that over 4 years has been allowed to expire. A total of $25 million of expired vaccines in the incinerator, gone up in smoke. That's really hard to account for. I mean, two things. First of all, there's the lost opportunity to protect people from infection. And then there's the opportunity cost of what that $20 million or so could have otherwise been used for. And the example I use is there are 50,000 women waiting for breast screening mammograms on the backlog, and it's $15 million to clear that backlog. Well, you know, if one could have done that instead of let the vaccines expire or purchase them in the first place, I'm sure that's what we'd rather have done.
What I've sort of been gathering from this press release is that you really see a strong mismanagement of funds in the current healthcare system. These vaccines were made available because people need them, and it seems like they weren't given to people in an efficient way. What would be your solution to making sure that everyone in the country is getting appropriately vaccinated?
So several things. First of all, supply needs to meet the demand, and the procurement needs to be timely. So if the vaccines are being purchased too far out for a program that can't be delivered like it was with the measles catch-up campaign, then that's a problem. I think also what we do is, as vaccines came close to expiry, we would get out to organisations of interest, such as the Meningitis Foundation, and out to primary care providers and say, look, these vaccines are going to expire in 6 months. We know the criteria was 13 to 25-year-olds who live in a hostel, a university facility or a boarding facility, but you know they're going to expire anyway, so move the criteria, and if you can use them into a target age group, then go ahead and use them. That's the sort of proposals we should be looking at to make sure we're not in this situation again.
That was Dr. Shane Reti from the National Party speaking to our news and editorial director, Anika Mohid, about the Māori Health Authority and $25 million in expired vaccines. You are on The Wire. I am your host, Christina, with Trishul producing today. If you have any thoughts on any of the pieces so far, we'd love to hear them. Send us a text on 5395. We'll be back with another piece after a quick break.
For a flatmate in a limb that's grey, you gotta be cool and you gotta be tough. You gotta be a vegan and no pets or smokers.
Room in Freeman's Bay Cottage. Me, urban sophisticate, wine expert, French cinema aficionado. You, educated, tidy, silent.
Room in flat, Mount Eden. Text Dave.
Whoever or wherever you're after, the 95BFM Accommodation Guide is here for you. Email your listing to accommodationguide@95bfm.com. The 95BFM Accommodation Guide, every Thursday on drive and online at 95bfm.com.
The Wire. That's funny. What does it sound like?
Genetically modified technologies and organisms have struggled to receive the research or approval needed for various biotechnological innovations in New Zealand. The last time a formal review was launched into GMs were in 2001, in accordance to the 1996 Hazardous Substances and New Organisms Act. I spoke with Ganesh Nana from the Productivity Commission to discuss why regulatory overhaul needs to occur and how this can be achieved to breed innovation. Firstly, I just want to ask, why is there a need to push for regulatory changes for accessing genetically modified technologies in terms of scientific advancement in the last 20 years?
What I think the Productivity Commission recommended was a review of the current regulatory arrangements, recognising that those arrangements were put in place more than 20 years ago, and technology has advanced and has changed, and indeed the whole concept of genetically modified organisms has changed considerably over the last 20 years, and we need to be make sure that our regulations are appropriate.
What sort of hurdles do you foresee in reviewing regulatory processes, whether that public sentiment or the government starts on having informed conversations?
Undoubtedly, it needs to be an informed conversation, and the government is obviously a key player, but as are the community and indeed sectors and industries and business and researchers and scientists. So it's across the board. We need an informed conversation about what GM is and how it has changed over the last couple of decades, and indeed be informed by what's happening in other parts of the world, recognising that some consumers and markets will be reluctant, and there's no doubt about that, and that has consequences as well. But the conversation needs to happen because our current regulatory arrangements are not fit for purpose, because the technology has advanced and the processes around GM have changed so much that it meant that our regulations are not appropriate anymore.
The technology sector has backed the call suggested by the Productivity Commission, as well as the New Zealanders for Health Research Chief Executive Chris Higgins. How does the support on this level assist the recommendations called for in this report?
Well, the recommendations in our report is very much around full review of the regulation to ensure that it's fit for purpose and that it does encourage innovation, supports innovation, supported and regulated accordingly depending on our objectives and consumer attitudes and of those of the community, in particular for Māori, but also recognising that the way that GMO have been now regulated is still from under the Hazardous Substances and New Organisms Act of 1996. So that's more than 20 years ago. It's time for a review. It's time for an informed conversation, not just from innovators and the agriculture sector and the health sector in terms of advances there, but also with the consumer and the wider population.
Innovations such as the Impossible Burger have been able to be imported into New Zealand under the current provisions. Despite this GM being allowed into the country, why has other newer technology struggled to make it across the border?
Well, the struggle to get across the border in terms of the newer technologies is because our regulations are out of date, and in the food standards regulations are different from the other that has no HSNO regulation. And so the call for the review is just to get things in line and get them up to date and get them relevant to the technology that's available today and is potentially coming across the border. And if it does come across the border, we need to be aware of it and it's regulated appropriately.
The New Zealand Firms Reaching the Frontier report also calls for reviews to the Biosecurity Act to allow for further innovation. How would such a change help to improve international collaboration on genetic material between New Zealand and other parts of the world?
That sort of the GM and other related innovations is one of the keys to ensure our biosecurity and also to ensure that we can meet the challenges of the future as biosecurity and other challenges confront us. The collaborations with other parts of the world are inevitable, and if our regulations are not up to speed, it does inhibit our ability to collaborate with other parts of the world and indeed get the best out of both worlds.
That was Ganesh Nana from the New Zealand Productivity Commission talking to me about their report calling for regulatory changes to genetically modified organisms and related technologies.
That was The Wire.
Hoera te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the show for another week. Thank you very much to everyone who spoke to us for the show today. And of course, a thank you to Trishel for producing today's show. What are you getting up to after this?
Honestly, just having a nice lunch and donating some blood.
Oh, that sounds very, very responsible, very socially responsible. I don't know if you guys tuned in last week, but there is a critical shortage of A positive blood, so make sure to keep that coming in. Thank you for sending in your insightful texts. It's always very nice to hear from you all. and I hope you enjoyed the show today. Thank you for tuning in. Up next is Jin with the 1-4. First, here is Toy Box by Current Bias. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.